Welcome to Triple Take, the podcast where we talk to interesting people about the book, album, and film that shaped them. I'm Carla Jean Whitley.
I'm John Hammontree.
And I'm Matt Scalise.
Our guest today is Matthew Mayfield, whose latest album is Recoil. And Matthew, how many albums have you released now? Because I have trouble keeping track.
There's been a bunch. This will be the fourth full length for me solo, and I made one with a band before, so
records. And a heck of a lot of EPs out there too. It's a nice problem to have trouble counting them up. I think you've got about a dozen available for purchase on your website right now.
Yeah, I think there's 150-ish songs in the catalog. Yeah. So a lot of music, but you know, some of which is better than others, but.
Well, isn't that true of everybody's work?
Yeah.
So you have been a mainstay of the Birmingham music scene for at least a decade. I feel like that's a safe estimate. I feel like we're getting older. How would you say this album sort of fits into your catalog or represents your sound and the evolution over these years?
It was definitely the most concise writing process for me. I've never made a record this fast. Went through just a bunch of stuff in my personal life, and then had my first case of writer's block before I started writing the record. This was probably back last year around this time, November, December. And I was picking up a guitar, and every time it would just feel like a brick, you know? And that's never happened to me before. So a couple months went by, and then as I got started to heal a little bit, it just sort of all it was spilled out within, you know, within 2 to 3 weeks I had the whole record, you know, which was, that never happens. But it's definitely, it's the most personal record I've ever made, which I think is why it's resonating better with people than even the Banquet record I did a couple years ago that seems to be a fan favorite. This one seems to rival it, or in a lot of people's case surpass it, just because they can relate. There's relatability to it. So.
Well, and of course you have played a variety of, I guess, genres. You've created a lot of music that has a lot of different sounds to it, and this album is fairly melodic while also holding on to some of that angst and deep emotion that we've heard in lots of your music. Do you feel like there is any way in which the lyrical content affects the sonic content of an album?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the lyrical themes on this one are, there's a lot of songs about betrayal. There's a lot of songs, but I think if there's really a running theme throughout the whole record, it's grief. But you know, grief isn't always bad or sad. You know, there's a song called Indigo, which is sort of about grieving someone you've lost, but, you know, sort of longing to see them on the other side. And it's like a letter to them. And there is some, you know, songs like Merry-Go-Round and Raw Diamond Ring, which is the next single, which I kept. You know, they're love songs, but I kept them because, you know, sometimes things are too good to throw into the fire. You know, you just don't want to burn it all, you know. And you hope that, you know, maybe that song that meant that to you, that doesn't mean that to you anymore, doesn't feel true anymore, could be someone else's anthem, you know, something that they hold on to. I've actually had a lot of people come up and tell me that, you know, this song, you know, is going to be my wedding song. This is going to be, you know, the theme of some, you know, just like, it's a beautiful concept to see it change. You know? You get to kind of give it away to other people.
Yeah, I think that's one of the neat things about music, or really any art form, is that the listener or reader, or what have you, kind of brings their own experience to the work. So you've got your intent, your message, mingling with the life of the person who is taking it in.
Absolutely.
And so what a song means to you, it may not be the same as what it means to me. So I know you have just a couple of shows listed on your website right now. Where can people find you and keep track of what's coming up on your schedule?
Well, I had to cancel a handful of gigs. I had a car accident, a pretty bad one, and cracked my sternum and bruised some ribs, and just made it to where I couldn't. Actually, had a gig the next day in Indianapolis. And so anyway, I had to cancel the majority of the dates because it's I can't sing, you know, I can't take deep breaths, so it's tough to push all that air out. But we're booking right now for January, February, March, and April will be in Europe.
Okay.
But the States will be in January, February, March, and I'll be out with the band again for a lot of the dates, which will be fun.
Great.
And you can, MatthewMayfield.com is the easiest place.
Yeah.
It just pops right up. So.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right, so today we're going to talk about the book, album, and film that have had the greatest influence on you. So before we jump into those, can you tell me what they are?
The book is Fargo Rock City. The film is the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. And the album is Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses.
This is gonna be fun. So one of my favorite things about this podcast is when people choose books that I already own. It makes my life a whole lot easier. But in this case, it's also just a lot of fun because anything Chuck Klosterman is going to make for good conversation.
Yeah. He's super clever and really funny.
So when did you read Fargo Rock City for the first time?
I've read it a couple of times. I think the first time was probably 5 or 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Not too long.
Okay.
I was turned on to it by a friend of mine that was in touring with me. Mm-hmm. We were on the road, and he was like, "Dude, if you know, we were talking about rock and roll, and particularly, you know, metal and hard rock from the late '70s, early '80s, and or late '80s as well." And he was like, "Dude, you haven't read this book?" And I was like, "No." He was like, "When we pass through Nashville, I'm going home and we'll get it and give it to you, and you're going to read the whole thing on the store."
Yeah.
Of course, the minute I read the first chapter, I mean, it was like I was 6 chapters deep within a few hours.
You know? Yeah.
I just like couldn't stop.
Yeah. And when you said that this was your pick, I thought, well, actually, that sounds like about the most Matthew Mayfield book I could think of. You know, at least from what I know of you from the past several years. So it does seem like that was a really well-chosen recommendation.
Yeah, it was. It was. And it's one of those things, it's like we were talking about before we turned the mics on. It's like it's hard to pick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's books that are like, you know, obviously the greats. You know, there's The Old Man and the Sea and The Alchemist and all these books that I love, but when you said influential and inspirational, that's truly when you're like, when something makes you go home and sort of changes your perspective on not just your own craft and career, but like, you know, the way you write things, not taking yourself too seriously. You know, you learn something from the author, which that, you know, for me was a big part of this book.
Yeah, so tell me about that experience. How did you walk away from this book? How did you see the influence?
Well, I loved how tongue-in-cheek his style is, and I loved how it was so clear that he and I came up around the same time, you know, and it was so funny because he's this kid from the suburbs that fell in love with all these, you know, glam rock bands, and then he found some hard rock bands that still hold up, like Guns N' Roses and Motorhead, and, you know, some of these bands that have been huge influences on me, yet he was a kid and was sort of enamored the same way that I was, even with the stuff that doesn't hold up, you know, and you can still see the value in, you know, some of those Motley Crue records, you know, and so, and I'm not knocking on Motley Crue if you're a fan, but I do think that it's sort of an understood thing that Poison doesn't hold up as well as Guns, you know, it's just like there's a depth. And I think Bret Michaels would probably say we don't hold up the same way that the band did.
At least if he's being honest.
We couldn't go tour stadiums for 2 years in a row right now.
Right, you know? In 2016, 2017.
Right. So I love that. And I also love that he, you know, Klosterman has a really, like, interesting perspective on, he could admit how much of a nerd he is.
Oh, yeah.
And that really helped me be like, dude, we're all, like, all of us that are mm-hmm. rock and roll fans, especially when you're, like, a diehard, mm-hmm. you're a nerd, man. There's nothing cool about being a fanboy.
Yeah.
Or a fangirl. There's nothing cool about it. But everybody's got something like that.
Absolutely. You know?
Even the, like, coolest people in the world would geek out around certain people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It just depends on who you are.
So right, what your thing is.
I appreciate him just humiliating himself mm-hmm. and putting these stories about him listening yeah. to these records and, you know, really thinking he could relate, you yeah. know, at age, whatever, 12 or 13
right.
to, you know, Shout at the Devil by Motley Crue. You know? Like, sure, it spoke to him, but yeah. like, you know, in a way that it, mm-hmm. it speaks to a young boy.
Right.
But like, you know, he wasn't, you know, doing cocaine mm-hmm. off of strippers in the back of the Roxy. You know?
Yeah, in Windermere, so, North Dakota.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the imagination that yeah. really, thank God, us all, especially at a young age. And it doesn't matter mm-hmm. if it was the 80s or 90s. It doesn't matter what time frame you were a kid. You know, there's always those bands. There's the right. Zeppelins, and then there's, you know, you can go all the way back to Chuck Berry and mm-hmm. Johnny Cash. And, you know, you can go back and see that, like, musicians of all generations were inspired by. It was a similar concept mm-hmm. when it comes to rock and roll. You know, obviously yeah. country stars, and it's a little different, but. When it comes to rock and roll music, there's something that sort of unifies you. And that's why the book was recommended by one of my best friends who just so happens to be one of the biggest rock nerds that I've
yeah.
met, and also is my exact same age.
Yeah, I love it. And, you know, it's funny, too, because so there's nothing inherently cool about Chuck Klosterman.
No.
And yet I read an essay a few years ago from, I think it was a woman who was serving at his wedding reception, who was just like, geeking out that she was working Chuck Klosterman's wedding reception.
Full
so it's
circle.
Cool, exactly, to see how we all have that thing, and sometimes we can be somebody else's thing.
Totally.
So, and you mentioned briefly his actual writing, the way that his words can sometimes surprise you or delight with how clever he is. Has that influenced or inspired your thought process as you write in
Absolutely.
Any way?
Yeah, it's encouraged me to take left turns.
Yeah.
You know, like sudden 90-degree turns, because that's what he does. You know, at the end of the chapter, he'll go, like, to take a super hard left, and you're like, whoa. Like, but it's funny, it's jarring, and it sticks with you. So
yeah.
musically, lyrically, there are times where I'm like, you know, there are parts in certain songs where I really take that hard 90-degree turn and make it work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, if it's you know, if it's too over the top, the producer and the band will be like, dude, that's
mm-hmm.
too much.
Right.
But there's if you finesse it and you make it the right way to go, I'm serious, you know, I think there was a few songs I wrote after I read that book that I was like, you know, I mean, why not? It feels natural to go this way.
Right.
Why?
So
and then also,
it.
You know, it helps you not take yourself too seriously, because he's so funny and so, like, I mean, obviously his craft is very mm-hmm. important to him, the same way that mine is. I take it very seriously and respect it and
mm-hmm.
revere it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, when you go out and play it for people, mm-hmm. and you go out and tell the stories and talk about the songs, you know, you don't have to. Yeah, every one of your stories doesn't have to, like, bring people to tears or,
right.
you know, like, you can be tongue-in-cheek. And then
yeah.
I started this side project called the Blue Cut Robbery
mm-hmm.
years ago, and it's just a four-piece rock and roll band. We made a record a couple years ago. It's called Coquette, and we put it out, and it's tongue-in-cheek, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole record, you know, lyrically is nothing like my solo
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Yeah.
But it was all true. It's all stuff that's happened on mm-hmm. the road. But you could write about it in a way that wasn't like you have to pine over every line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could just sort of
mm-hmm.
spit it out and make sure that it felt right melodically. But if you're telling a story about, you know, some cracked out Motel 6 in, you know, the middle of Missouri,
mm-hmm.
you know, that experience is worth writing about.
You're right.
And sometimes it fits into the thing.
you chose for your album an album that might have been the first album that I sort of obsessively listened to as a teenager. And I think that's when a lot of people, especially kind of our generation and the one before and after it, encounter it. I think I might have been 14 or 15 when I heard this. What was your first encounter with this?
Appetite was the first record that I recall falling in love with as a little kid. I think Jungle was the first experience that I had with the record, the first song.
Yeah, now I definitely, I think, and a lot of people too have heard Welcome to the Jungle or Sweet Child of Mine, probably, and maybe Paradise City are kind of like, those are the ones you hear even if you've never listened to this album. Sure. They make it into pop culture somehow. But yeah, like, just tell me about your experience kind of just really digging all the way into it.
Well, I think when I heard that squeal and that, you know, swagger, and I saw the band on MTV, you know, and I saw Slash and that hair and that cigarette and that hat and Duff and Izzy and, you know, even Steven, who looked the most 80s at the time, he still looked cool behind the kit, I thought, you know. But it was one of these things where they were so different from everything that was happening in 80s rock and roll, because not only were they musically far more superior as players and singers and just musicians to the majority of the bands that were, you know, on labels and getting radio play, but they also had a danger to them that no other band had. And the danger was what sucked all of us in. You know, it's because you could see straight through Poison, you could see straight through some of the old, even the older Motley Crue stuff. You didn't see a band that was living the songs, and they also weren't writing just about, you know, strippers and drugs. It was like they were writing, sure, there's some of that, they were also writing, like, I mean, you know, the original lyrics to Welcome to the Jungle were written on a pizza box, you know,
right.
You know what I mean, like, these guys were like in the throes of the Sunset Strip, but they were like also inspired by Elton John and the Beatles and Led Zeppelin, and you could hear all those influences. And so the magic of their songwriting, and especially Izzy Stradlin, the, you know, the main songwriter at the time, you know, it was just like, these are classic rock and roll songs that will never die. You know?
Do you feel like, I think, because you mentioned kind of the comparison to the other sort of, you know, hair bands, and there's much less of the sort of cute metaphor, you know, like double entendre stuff. They're not singing about cherry pie and pour some sugar on me. It's just flat out like, yeah, we're singing about drugs and sex and all of this stuff. The sort of element of it, of your parents not being okay with it, I think probably was a big part of what appeals about this album. And it's still probably, I think, a lot of people would cringe at their kids listening to this a certain age. Yeah.
Shit.
So, I mean, was that, what was kind of your age level, I think, when you, do you remember how old you were when you would have started really getting into this band?
It was early. I think about 9 or 10.
Yeah.
So my folks definitely didn't like it.
Yeah, right.
You know, I was way too young to understand anything that they were singing about. But it was just that visceral energy, mm-hmm. the sound. You know, I started playing guitar right around then, and Slash was everything to me. You know, Slash was the main reason he's the reason I'm sitting here right now as a professional musician.
So explain to me, because this is a thing that I love to, I love music. I don't have any background in understanding the mechanics of it and how it works. I've peeked into it enough to know, like, man, this is some complicated stuff here.
Yeah.
Explain to me as best you can, what makes Slash, why can I recognize a Slash guitar riff? And me as a layperson who does not play guitar,
yeah.
Why can I recognize his stuff?
Immediately.
What is it about him that sticks out?
Well, stylistically, he's the best in terms of, like, I've never heard a guitar player morph Jimmy Page, Joe Perry, and some of the, like, even guys like, I mean, well, we can edit this.
Yeah, that's fine.
Joe Perry, Jimmy Page, and Eric Clapton are all have these just definitive things. When they
right.
play, you know. It's like, you know, you just know it's them the minute you hear them. Slash has that thing, and it's because he's mixing all the styles of, that he grew up listening to, along with this, I'm trying not to get too nerdy. There's a mode in music. There's these, you know, scales and there's modes. And there's a mode called Mixolydian. He mixes in Mixolydian with all that bluesy, pentatonic, rock and roll thing. And so when people hear him play, they're like, how does he do it? Like, how does this guy do it? And I saw him play on the reunion tour this past year, and everyone was like, Slash stole the show. Like, how does he do it? How does this guy, like, you know, he's in his 50s and he can shred. And like, but the thing about shredding is, like, sure, it's cool when people play fast. Everybody can play mm-hmm. fast. But it's that you can sing every single one of the solos on that record.
Right.
You can hum them, like Sweet Child especially.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
And like, even though they're fast and they're crazy and it's amazing, it's still like you can hum them the same way that you can hum, you know, the easiest Clapton solo ever, mm-hmm. you know, or the easiest David Gilmour solo ever, you know, which, you know, comfortably numb is arguably the best guitar solo of all time. You can hum every note, but you can also hum every note to the Sweet Child solo, which is pretty cool.
So the other thing about this album in particular that is kind of a defining thing about it to me is this is it for them. I mean, there were other albums. You can pick and choose little things that they did after this that are cool and that you like, but there was nothing else after this from them that was even remotely as cohesive as this. Sure. So, you know, I guess, first of all, what is it about? Do you think that's part of the appeal, that this was a short-lived thing, that this was just this quick, perfect burst from this band, and we didn't really, like, get tired of them?
Well, it's a very appropriate title. For a band that only lasted 4 to 6 years, depending on mm-hmm. which record you say is their last.
Right.
I don't count the spaghetti incident.
So. A lot of the other ones do feel just kind of, well, we found some other stuff laying on the floor. We can slap it together here.
But yeah, they imploded very quickly. And I think that band was meant to do that. You know, they were made because they lived it and they lived that life so hard. They were made to die. You know, very quickly. And, you know, the interesting thing about that band that's worth noting is, you know, Axl Rose is by far the most egomaniacal psychopath, you know, frontman that there's ever been in rock and roll history. And that, in my opinion, is a fact. And I've done a lot of studying, you know. And this dude is incredible. He's like, that is what draws you to him, is that he's such a word that I can't say on this microphone.
Yeah.
There's so many things about this guy that make him so terrible, so self-involved, so egomaniacal, yet that is what made him so great as a frontman.
Right.
You know, he didn't care if he went on stage 3 hours late and there was 60,000 people waiting and he's just eating pizza.
Probably made it better. He liked that everybody had to wait on him and was, yeah.
And it made sense to him. In his head, he was like, I'm not ready yet. There's six, and the tour manager's like, hey man, there's 60,000 people that paid $100 to see you play.
Right.
And you're saying you're not going to go on because you're eating pizza at the hotel? Or you're still on the plane?
Right.
Like, what's happening? And they're like, he's like, I'm not there yet, man. I'm not there. I'm not in the zone.
Right.
The reason the band was so hammered half the time is because all they were doing in the dressing room was drinking. And by the time Axl's ready to go on, they're all hammered.
Right.
You know, but they played great. And obviously, you know, the band is revered as one of the greatest bands of all time, but that record is the highest selling debut record of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason for that, because it's classic and incredible. And we could rattle off Deep Cuts for forever.
Yeah, I will. I do want to wrap up. I want to do this because I've looked at the track listing really quickly. There's
Hit me.
9 out of the first 10 songs I could argue are my favorite on the album. But if you, so I'm going to take away Welcome to the Jungle from you.
Yep.
I'm going to take away Paradise City and Sweet Child of Mine, and you have to pick a favorite outside of those three.
Ooh. Hands down, without a doubt, my favorite Guns N' Roses song is track 3 off that record, and it's called Night Train.
Yeah.
Great choice. It's got all of the elements. When somebody says, like, give me a definitive record, like a definitive Guns N' Roses song, what do you want me to listen to? I'm like, Night Train is the song. It's got all the elements. It's got all the musicality. It's got a great solo. It's got a great melody.
Has the fist pump thing where it's like made to be like singing it in yeah. your car with other people.
I think it should have been a single.
Yeah. I mean, you got to say that about all of them. But like the other thing that I think is great about that song, and it kind of fits with the whole album, is that song is great. You love it. You had a great time. And then as soon as it's over, Out to Get Me comes on, and you're like, God dang, is this album ever going to slow down? Yeah, like, man. It just keeps going one after the other one.
And it never stops.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking to me about this album and letting me geek out about it with you a little bit.
We'll geek out some more when the mics are off.
Pivoting to a much slower, more contemplative 3 hours of entertainment. In 2007, that was a really weird big year for Westerns, because you had 310 to Yuma, the remake, come out. You had No Country for Old Men. You had There Will Be Blood. And then you had the film that you've chosen today that has the longest title I think I've ever heard of for a movie, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. So in a year of good, slow, contemplative Westerns, why did this movie jump out to you?
Well, it's interesting you say that. It was tough between this one and There Will Be Blood, because Daniel Day-Lewis is by far my favorite actor.
Me too.
But I this film was so inspiring visually. It's one of the most beautiful pieces of art I've ever seen. I've referenced this film more in music videos and album art, and I named my side project after a scene.
Yeah, that's right. Robert, yeah.
When they robbed the train in Blue Cup, Missouri.
Yep.
The performances were incredible. I think Brad Pitt did a great job. I think Casey Affleck was incredible at that character, playing that, ultimately a stalker. He was essentially an obsessive.
Yeah, it's funny because we were talking earlier about fanboys, and I mean, he's an obsessive fanboy of, like the rock and roller of his generation, exactly. Jesse James.
I think that's, when I started to think about all these, like these three things that he picked, I think rock and roll is probably a big part of it. Because Jesse James, especially the sort of legendary part of him, The reality, there was a lot of brutality and a lot of violence and a lot of things that are not cool, much less rock and roll. But there's a legacy about him that's sort of just been, it's been bloated. But they definitely did a great job in the movie picking Brad Pitt, who's, got that swagger about him. And then I think he sort of dove into the character and became that. He's always one step ahead of everyone else in the film.
Yeah.
And he's especially always one step ahead. He unriddles Robert Ford. And Robert Ford essentially is trying to do the right thing. At the end of the day, he's trying to bring down this criminal, this man who's done all these horrible things, yet everyone in the film reveres and likes Jesse better than they like him.
Yeah.
And well, he hates that.
And Jesse kind of sets him up. I mean, there are different ways to interpret the film, but you get the sense that he knows what Robert's going to do. Mm-hmm. And he turns his back to him, has Robert shoot him while he is unarmed.
Yep.
And, he cements Robert's legacy while also cementing his own. And, at some point, one of his men was going to turn him in. Somebody was going to catch him. At some point, Jesse was going to go out, and it's better to go out as a legend than to kind of quietly fade. And I think, you know, we talked about Guns N' Roses just now. You know, they had this one great thing, and then they didn't really fade. They just kind of disappeared. And, you know, I think that is, I can see why that would make sense to you as a rock and roll motif.
Yeah,
it Do you relate more to Jesse or to Robert?
I relate a lot to both of them, but in different ways, but I would say more to Jesse, you know, because I feel like he, you know, when I came out of the movie for the first time, which I've seen it, I mean, I'm one of those people that watches films, the same ones over and over, like, I'll just put them on late at night, you know, just watch them, and I'll watch a scene, or I'll watch the whole thing, I don't know. But that one's probably gotten more spins than anything in the last since it came out in 07. But I definitely related to Jesse's character in the movie, just because he's got, you know, he's the front man of his operation. You know? He sort of has to be in charge of the James Boys. He has to be in charge of, you know, his new little clan with Robert being part of that. And being a leader of a band is, you know, there is a similarity, and having been a leader of a band and everything that I've done, there's a, at times you do have to be harsh, which there's scenes where he's super harsh, and at times you have to be gentle, and at times you have to navigate your family and your friends, and, you know, you have to figure out all these pieces of the puzzle, and I think all of that was essentially what drove him insane. And I don't, you know, obviously the film doesn't necessarily line up exactly with Jesse's, you know, legacy, but I feel like the character, he has this, there's a pressure on him, and you can feel it weighing on him, especially in that scene when he's looking down into ice, and he's got that big bear fur on, and he's like, do you ever think about, basically he's like, do you ever think about ending it all? He starts shooting the ice with the fish, and there's just something about all of that where you're like, you know, he's, there's a weight on him, and you can feel it, and it's really palpable in the performance. So
when you've got this changing cast of both, like, his bandmates, for lack of a better terms, but then also, you know, his fans and his groupies, and he's constantly surrounded by just this changing group of characters and peoples, but like you said, the front man kind of stays the same. Have you had any experiences with an obsessive fan, kind of like Robert Ford?
Unfortunately, yes, I have.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I won't name any names, but thankfully they're out of town. But yeah, I've had some really scary experiences over the years. You know, people finding out what hotel you're staying in, they're by your door when you get there. That's happened before. I've had someone come to the venue before we even got there at 3 o'clock and pull a chair in front of the load-in door and just sit. And, you know, when we pulled up, thankfully I had a band with me, a tour manager, and they handled it for me. But there have been some really intense experiences. Oh, because it's been, you know, a long time. I think, you know, I've been doing it since I was 19, and I'm 33 now. So there have definitely been some scary moments, but none involving weaponry.
Right, no attempts on your life.
Revolvers, yeah. No John Lennon experiences, but ones that get rattle you a little bit.
Yeah. Well, speaking of music, you talked about the visual imagery having an impact on your music videos and things like that, but what about the Nick Cave soundtrack? Do you feel that working into your music?
Absolutely, man. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Everything about that movie is just gorgeous. Yeah, the visual, but I love how the visual and the audio are so perfectly, you know, like wound together.
Yeah.
You know? There's something really beautiful about the soundtrack, everything about that melancholy string section throughout the whole movie. And there's themes, you know. And I know that happens, that's a sort of a deal in a lot of films, but there's these really noticeable themes. It's kind of like, you know, when the Joker comes on screen in the Dark Knight, you know, it's like there's always that one note on the cello, you know.
Yeah.
And there's certain parts in this film where where the, you know, there's when you know something's about to happen or something dark is about to come out of his mouth. And I love that. So the soundtrack is gorgeous. And then, you know, that opening scene with him in the field, you know, that I reference that a lot, and I reference the a lot of the stuff where he's when he's walking through the field and he, you know, he's missing a finger. Just touching the wheat, and it's just the like golden hour factor of so much of this movie. And a lot of that probably had to do with color grading and in post, which God bless whoever did that. He did an amazing job.
I did, yeah.
And but yeah, I've referenced that movie more than anything else, and it, for music videos, hands down.
Okay, know. Well, we'll have to go watch some of your music videos and see if we can catch.
There's a new one coming out tomorrow, Wednesday. So I don't want to date this. So it's the 7th.
December 7th. Okay.
Video coming out December 7th called God's Fault, and I wanted to meld. The visual of that film with the first season of True Detective.
Okay. Oh, that's a lot of good visuals there.
Put those two together and try our best to get there. And I think we did a decent job on a very small budget.
We'll drop a link to that in the story when it goes live.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Absolutely.
If thanks our listeners want to find you on social media, where would they need to go?
I think everything's Matthew Mayfield, Instagram, Twitter, and then Facebook's just Matthew Mayfield Music.
Okay.
And then my website's MatthewMayfield.com.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm John Hammondtree. You can find me on Twitter at John Hammondtree.
I'm Matt Scalise. You can find me on social media at Matt Scalise.
I'm Carla Jean Whitley, and you can find me all over social stuff at Inkstained Life.
And y'all be sure to download us on iTunes and give us a rating. Thanks.